You ready? Coming down in a three and a two and a one.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South American. All the ships at sea. Let's go to press.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story. And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
Hello. I think the media is among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever met. Good
sir. One of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides.
What Boehner is angry with is the American people holding him accountable.
If I become president, oh, do they have problems. They're going to have such problems.
Well, I don't know why that's funny.
It's the Ricochet Podcast with Rob Long and Peter Robinson. I'm James Lilex, and today we have both sides of the Trump question, Charlie Sykes from Wisconsin and Victor Davis Hanson from California. Let's have ourselves a podcast. Welcome, everybody, to this, the Ricochet Podcast, number 325. We're brought to you by Harry's Shave. Why? Well, because we like you to look good. And for a great shave at a great price, go to harrys.com and enter that coupon code Ricochet when you check out. And we're brought to you by our newest sponsor, Texture. What is it? Well, Texture allows you to breeze through hundreds of your favorite magazines, including back issues, and pick the articles that interest you the most. Get a free trial right now when you go to texture.com/ricochet. And we're brought to you by... Well, let me just put it this way. It's no secret that a lot of guys aren't great at making time to shop for clothes, but they still want to look good, right? Right? Well, Trunk Club can help. I'll tell you a little bit more about those later in the show. And the show, of course, being brought to you by the enterprise, the ongoing great concatenation of voices that is Ricochet. And that little genial chuckle tells you that Rob Long is here to make you feel guilty that you're listening for free.
Well, not guilty. I'm not guilty. My offer to you is that if you like what you're hearing and you're a member, we thank you. We're pleased to have members be members along with you. If you like what you're hearing and you're not a member, we really do need you to join. We've got a pretty bad but right now we're at a pretty dire situation here. We need 879 members left to go. We have 10, 15, 20 times that in weekly downloads. Is that right? It's more than that.
Many times more.
It's in the tens and tens and tens of thousands. Not quite 100, but it's close. And so we really do need you to help us out. Ricochet.com is the fast-growing civil conversation on the web. We are striking a blow against all this troll, nonsense, swampy comment section. We do it in a free market way. If you're a member, you get to comment. You have to keep to the code of conduct. And, you know, we had a meetup on Wednesday. Members only meet up in Manhattan to watch the debate, and it was a lot of fun. And we had sort of Trumpers and no Trumpers and never Trumpers and MAGAs, and everybody was there, and everybody got along very civilly. That was the in-person IRL version of what we do on Ricochet, trying to make this clean up the internet and make it a good place. And I feel like people on the center right should be leading that way. Please join Ricochet.com, get a free month, and it's absolutely no risk to you. Just try it out, and I know that you'll be addicted. Just to be honest with you, our retention rates, our member retention rates, when people try us out for a free month, they skyrocket. We show that number to people in advertising and sort of various other funding communities, and they always look at us like, well, you guys have figured it out. And we figured out everything except how to keep it afloat. So that's your job along with ours. So please help us and join.
Yes. Well, we have figured it out. And the way is that when you have the unsubscribe page goes to a 404 every time, eventually people just give up.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you just have to look at it. It's a P.O. box and it's in, you know, Guam. And it's only – they only receive mail from 11 to 11:15. Yeah.
Well, speaking of computer problems, the internet today, the day that we're doing this, is suffering a massive DDoS.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is it's probably – you know, who possibly could have done this? Well, let's look. Europeans and the Yanks, I believe, in concert, arrested a Russian hacker in Czechoslovakia, or I'm sorry, in Czechia. And this is probably tit for that tat, or not. This strange electronic war that rages around and above and beneath us that we have no idea is transpiring, but yet that's probably what's going on. And at the center of it all this week, of course, and last and next, is WikiLeaks. Let me ask you guys something. Do you believe everything that WikiLeaks puts out?
Peter? What do you mean? Do you mean the emails?
Yeah.
I frankly, I do tend to, yes.
Yeah.
I have yet to see – well, they, first of all, who would have the – they don't get paid for this stuff. So who on earth would take the time to fake thousands and thousands of emails? Item one.
Russian
item two,
Russian intelligence service is the answer to that.
Item two, the clincher is that the Democratic National Committee need only turn over – well, they could take two or three samples.
Right.
This hour on this date, this hour on this date, this hour on this date, we'll have the FBI come in and show all the traffic that went in and out and match it up against WikiLeaks and prove that those documents are fraudulent. They have made no such attempt to do so. Even when – after the debate the other evening, even when Donna Brazile got in her temper tantrum with – under questioning from Megyn Kelly, and Megyn Kelly – questioned Donna Brazile about a couple of things that Donna Brazile had written in a WikiLeaks. Donna Brazile said, I will not be persecuted. Those things are illegal. And Megyn Kelly said, are you saying you did not write them? And Donna Brazile would not go that far. She was just trying to it's sort of the outrage, blow an outrage, smokescreen of outrage. She didn't deny writing them. The answer is yes. Sorry, I'm not giving you a longer answer. Yes.
Okay, Rob. Let me ask you this then. If these were being put out by a foreign, if these were being facilitated, shall we say, not that they're fake to start with, but that their release and dissemination is being facilitated by.
Yeah, I believe that is true. Yeah.
Do you believe if that's the case that this organization would deny itself the opportunity to salt and lard the dump with some disinformation?
Salt and lard. You're speaking my language.
And a pickle and a horseradish vodka. You've got yourself an afternoon.
Yeah. But maybe,
the Southern Foodways Alliance.
Yeah, exactly. Salt and lard. That's kind of our battle cry. Maybe. Look. These things, they don't seem very surprising to me, and they certainly don't seem like they're turning anybody's head. There's all this drum roll. If I was going to collect the themes of this latter part of this election together, I would say it's a lot of talk. It's a lot of wind coming out of WikiLeaks. Oh, we're going to show that Donna Brazile gave the questions. That'd be bad, but come on, you're surprised by the questions? If you're a candidate for the presidency of the United States and you're surprised by the questions, you're not prepared for them, there's other problems. I mean, there are only 10 questions that you know what they're kind of generally be about. And then the email, the Podesta emails read to me like classic John Podesta. And what's interesting about it is that it confirms what we already know, which is that people within an organization, especially a political organization, tend to despise each other with passion. You know, they all hate Chelsea Clinton. Chelsea Clinton hates them. They all hate Doug Band. Doug Band hates them. Everybody hates everybody else, which makes sense because they're not, you know, they're not the best people. They're the best people. They'd be, you know, doing something useful like working at the Quiznos. But that's my first point. My second point is like, you can even see it other on the Trump side that this all this talk from this blowhard fooled Steve Bannon about, oh, I'm going to bring you Obama's half brother. That'll rattle her. All that stuff, though, I'm going to bring in Bill Clinton's women. That'll rattle her. It's just all such low rent clown show that the WikiLeaks, all that stuff just seems silly to me. And it is simply having zero effect. It is having zero effect on the campaign.
Okay, I grant 95% of what Rob said. The WikiLeaks didn't tell anybody anything he didn't already know. We know that Hillary Clinton is a crook. We know that Donald Trump is a blowhard and a loudmouth. And we know that the people who run Hillary Clinton's campaign, call them whatever you want, the technocratic elite, they're essentially at war with the underlying values, the fundamental values of middle America. I grant every bit of that. Everybody already knew that. There is one development here, which is just a little bit beneath the radar. And because of my profession of faith, I may be sensitive to it. I do believe if you skimmed around on Catholic blogs over the last couple of days,
right,
some Catholics and particularly some bishops were genuinely shocked by the anti-Catholic material in the emails. I wasn't. I think a lot of Catholics understood that that was going on.
Yeah.
But some of those poor, dear, naive bishops who were raised in Irish or Italian homes with a picture of Pope John the 23rd and John Fitzgerald Kennedy both taped to the kitchen wall, right? Those guys can hardly believe the Democratic Party has become what it has become. And this was a slap in the, not a slap in the face, because it wasn't insulting. It was a bucket of cold water. It woke them up.
Everybody's that they have an effect. Everybody's been worried that the party is not exactly what they thought that it was. Speaking of Catholics, though, Al Smith, there was a dinner. Nice collegial event. Rob, before we go to our first guest, you're a quip writer.
I did participate a little bit in the quip writing.
You are a quipmeister. What exactly – how hard is this exactly? I mean, they give this job to the writers and do the what do you think the parameters are? What makes it work? Is it self-deprecation more than it is vitriol?
Yeah, it's self-deprecation, and it's good, solid jokes that – look, a self-deprecating joke or a joke like that at a very high-stakes time simply telegraphs to your audience that you are close to a normal human being, right? That you kind of see the world almost as clearly as they do, right? You're aware of what's really happening in the world and how people perceive you. I worked a little bit on the quips for Mitt Romney 4 years ago, and he did a fantastic job. Barack Obama did a great job. Bill Clinton Bill Clinton blew one of those. And it's not that hard. You know, you just go, you put on a white tie and you make some jokes and you're done. It's actually kind of a weird room. I mean, the room itself is very strange. You're actually sitting on this raised risers on stage. It's not like you're at a dinner and there's a dais and then you stand up. It's like there's people in the audience watching you eat. It's very, very strange. It's a really weird dinner. And the diners themselves are sort of raked back like, a high school chorus. It's really weird. But the standards are pretty simple. And look, I think Donald Trump's got to – I am not licensed to practice psychiatry in the state of New York or California for that matter or anywhere else. But let's not dot those I's. I will only say this, that you could see him throwing the material away the way sometimes movie stars do when they don't like it or when they don't think they don't want to do it. It's not comfortable. The self-deprecating stuff isn't comfortable, which is weird because he actually does it pretty well when he does it. And you can just kind of see him not get the tone. And it was, I think it'll have zero effect on anyone, but, and I think we should say that the only thing that connects to what Peter just said is that the Al Smith dinner is a Catholic Charities dinner, put on by the Cardinal, right? Peter, why am
Correct.
I talking about
yes.
Catholic
doctrine? I think you were assuming that listeners would understand. Yeah. It's a Catholic dinner. It's named in honor of Al Smith. Al Smith was a governor of New York. He was also a devout Catholic. He was a Democrat. That's when this goes way back to the early to the 1920s, as I recall. Fundraising dinner been held in his honor ever since, every 4 years. Both candidates always presided over by the Cardinal Archbishop of New York. And this is very interesting because I wasn't there, but just to look on YouTube, this seems to me to be correct. The cardinal is seated between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And one of them does not live up to the church's teaching in personal morals, and the other flouts the church's teaching on ethics and life. And that was what a tense – of course, what this shows is the way that the political culture has drifted away from – ordinary religious. I mean, 30 years ago, you'd have a Democrat when it's Dwight Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson. They both accept basic Christian morality. That's not even in question. And now
I think it's fair to say that the most Catholic candidate to appear at the Al Smith dinner in the past 50 years was Mitt Romney.
Yes, I would agree. I would agree.
Well, with those two on either side of a religious figure, it's a wonder they didn't burst into flames and have their faces melted like the Nazis at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was fun to watch, though. I mean, the ratio of vitriol to self-deprecation, you have to be careful because the audience does want to see – they do want to see blood drawn.
Agreed.
You don't want to see blood drawn when you're shaving because that means you're using a cheap razor.
Beautiful.
That's why I'm telling you that if you want a good razor, a great razor, a fantastic razor at an even better price, well, you go where – else you know where to go. You go to Harry's. Now, the big razor companies have this annoying habit, and you probably noticed they put out new models and they raise their already high prices. Well, unlike those guys, Harry's does not believe in upcharging, which is why they've made their razors even better, and they're keeping prices exactly the same. Now, Harry's five-blade razors now include a softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide, a trimmer blade for those hard-to-reach places, a lubricating strip, textured handle for more control when it's wet, in case you use it in the shower, your wife uses it for her legs, and still just $2 a blade compared with $4 or more that you'll pay at the drugstore. Now, by owning the factory in Germany where they make these blades, Harry's, as you well know by now, can produce high-quality razors and sell them online for half the price. Here's your special offer today. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they'll send you their popular free trial set, which comes with a razor, five-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. And you get it free when you sign up for a shave plan, and you just pay for shipping. Plus, there's a special offer for you. Just enter that coupon code RICOCHET at checkout to get a post-shave balm added to your order for free. So go to harrys.com right now and enter the code RICOCHET at checkout to claim your free trial set and free post-shave balm. That's harrys.com. Then enter the code RICOCHET at checkout. And we thank Harry's for sponsoring this, the RICOCHET podcast.
I love that post-shave balm, got to say.
We welcome now to the podcast Charlie Sykes. He's a radio talk show host at WTMJ in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he's also the editor of Right Wisconsin. You can follow him on Twitter at SykesCharlie. Charlie, I'm over here in Minnesota, so I understand you're going to be, how shall I say, in the market soon, or out of your market? Ever thought of starting up some talk radio in Minneapolis? We need it.
Oh, boy. You know what? Wisconsin's been a heavy lift. I don't think I could handle Minnesota, too.
But you're leaving. You're leaving broad now. Is it this the season that finally snapped it for you?
You know, that's an interesting question. No, I'd had this date circled for a long time, kind of a personal decision having to do with when my father passed away. But I will admit that this campaign made that decision a lot easier. I mean, seeing what is happening to the conservative movement, seeing what's happening to the conservative media, this seemed like a really good time to maybe walk back, sit down a little bit, and ask the question, what the hell just happened here?
Charlie, Peter Robinson here. Two questions for you, and you've had a while to reflect on both of these. How did Wisconsin defeat Donald Trump in your primary? And was it something that could have been done in other places, in other state primaries? In other words, was Donald Trump stoppable if only a few other states had done what you all did in Wisconsin? Or was Donald Trump onto something so deep and so large about American politics that he was going to get the nomination anyway? What do you think?
Boy, that is a great question. You know, I saw somebody on Twitter describing Wisconsin and Utah as being the designated drivers for the conservative movement. And I mean, I certainly hoped at the time that we were going to be this firewall of rationality in the campaign. And of course, it didn't turn out that way. You know, I think things were different here for a couple of reasons. Number one, because I think the conservative movement, the Republican Party, had avoided the kind of divisions that had popped up elsewhere. I think that we had been more serious, more refined, reform-minded. Conservatives here had been battle-tested through the recalls, recalls of Governor Walker.
Right.
We'd also, been marinating for more than a decade in the kind of, serious intellectual approach to conservative policies, represented by a Paul Ryan and many of the think tanks here. At a different level, we also have a different infrastructure of talk radio. While Donald Trump was able to have air cover from, the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys and the Laura Ingrams elsewhere, mm-hmm. We had most of the talk show hosts in Wisconsin were not drinking that Kool-Aid, were subjecting him to a great deal of scrutiny. And as a result, he didn't have the kind of air cover. He was actually challenged. So if that had happened elsewhere, if he had been exposed more aggressively, if Republicans had been more serious about, what was about to happen and what was at stake, yeah, he could have been stopped. But again, I can't really speak to that. You look back on the lack of principled opposition, the rolling over, the cynicism of the Republican establishment and other wings of the party, and you wonder whether the history could have been differently, could have turned out differently. And of course it could have, but it didn't.
So I know my friend on the line here, Rob Long, wants to get in, and I'm sure James has, your fellow upper Midwesterner James wants back in. But I have one more question. We're hearing already, and Lord knows we're going to hear more of it after the election if the outcome is what is the way it now looks it will be. What we're hearing is the Republican Party needs to find a way to reach out to the people it has ignored, the old Reagan Democrats, blue collar, frankly, often white people without college degrees. Okay. You understand the argument. You understand what's being said. Yeah. And there in Wisconsin, Charlie Sykes sits in Milwaukee. Scott Walker got launched as a county executive, as I recall, right there in Milwaukee. In other words, Paul Ryan knows how to reach it. What you've got in Wisconsin is a conservatism that has already somehow or other figured out how to reach out to enough. There's nothing about the Wisconsin Republican Party or the Wisconsin conservative movement that seems elitist or distant from the people, the ordinary people of Wisconsin. How did you do that? What's the substance of it?
Well, you know, you're exactly right, because we are not a blue state. I mean, I'm sorry, we are not a red state. This is a state that votes for Democrats. And in order to get elected in Milwaukee or southeastern Wisconsin, you have to appeal to exactly the kind of Democrat that you're talking about. So, you know, we have always kept in mind that we needed to be able to speak to blue collar workers, to rural folks out there. And obviously, this is something that needs to be done. We need to do it without Trumpism. There needs to be a separation of the personality of Donald Trump and some of the toxic policies. But there's no question about it that nationally, you have a lot of Republicans that have just overlooked this population. Here in Wisconsin, that's just not possible. There's no way you win an election in a presidential election year or an off year unless you get exactly those kinds of votes. And so Scott Walker is running up margins in places that before 2000 were heavily Democratic. And so, yes, this is something that I would, of course, urge people to do. Come to Wisconsin and see what's actually worked, because, you know, that may be a model for other states.
Right.
Hey, it's Rob Long in New York. Thanks for joining us. Hey, so you mentioned Wisconsin, and Wisconsin's always seemed to me to be kind of like, you know, as a little mini America in that respect, and certainly in this part of the 21st century, a little bit blue, a little bit red. But can we just talk about those two names you just mentioned? Because, you know, full disclosure, I think I know what's going to happen in 3 weeks in November. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be a disaster. And I think that when the dust clears, we're going to have a very wounded Paul Ryan. And we're going to be looking around for an untainted national Republican leader or leaders. And I'm worried about Scott Walker, because I feel like I was hoping and cheering for him. And he just didn't make the cut. Is Scott Walker going to make the cut again?
Well, those are really good questions. And I'm worried about those things as well. Among the things that Donald Trump will destroy in his path, I think will perhaps be Paul Ryan's political future. And he's going to lose. Uh-huh. He's going to lose badly here. Scott Walker's up for re-election in 2018. I think it's going to be somewhat problematic for him, because he's underwater. If 2018 is a strong Republican year, he might be able to pop back. But the thing about Walker, though, I mean, his campaign, you know, obviously was not a textbook example of how to win, but he was smart enough to know when to get out. And don't underestimate him. He actually ran for governor in the state of Wisconsin back in 2006, and he withdrew from the race when he realized it wasn't going to happen for him. Mm-hmm. And people at the time thought, well, that's terrible. It turned out to be his smartest decision, because so he obviously is going to be interested in 2020. But again, at this point, I don't know that anybody knows what the landscape's going to look like after November 8th, how bad the damage is going to be. You know, how far is Donald Trump and the Breitbart folks going to push this, you know, the recrimination primaries? I mean, are they going to pound the rubble afterwards? You know, will this party be able to regain its sanity between now and 2020? So I'm not sure who is the untainted candidate after this debacle.
Maybe it's, again, it's somebody we haven't heard of, somebody who comes in clean with no baggage at all, no connection at all to 2016, which I think would probably be the most logical choice. So I got another question. I mean, one of the arguments I've been making since March has been that our side has had this kind of strange problem with scale, where we watch Fox News and we read right-wing blogs and we listen to right-wing radio, and we think that there's a national movement for conservatism or for our views. And we forget that, of course, we have a very slender non-filibuster-busting majority in the Senate, and a kind of a very thin reed in the House. We do really well in states. We do really well in state houses. Not so great in the national on the national stage. And a lot of people put the blame on talk radio. Do you accept that?
Yeah. Oh, I do. Absolutely. And in fact, this is one of the things that I've been trying to puzzle through is how we got here. I actually think that it's not just a matter of scale. It's also a matter of our success in creating an alternative reality media bubble. I mean, we have created these silos in which conservatives can think they are much bigger and much louder than they really are, and that we talk to one another. And as a result, you have things like Breitbart and Donald Trump and InfoWars, which are able to peddle the most bizarre sort of conspiracy theories without being challenged on the scale that you're talking about. I think one of the shocks of this year is to realize that the conservative movement was not what we thought it was. Our allies were not who we thought they were. We had been talking to each other so long that we kind of missed the way in which we had become separated from our base, but also increasingly alienated from the general culture. And I think we're going to see that in November. I think you take Donald Trump out of this equation, and conservatives are going to look around and realize how out of step we are with the general culture, because we had thought that everybody read and saw the same sorts of things that we did. Now, you asked me about talk radio. I make a distinction between Wisconsin talk radio and the national guys. But,
everybody in Wisconsin always does, and I think it's probably fair.
We want to. Yeah, well, I want to because I listen to, a fanboy like Sean Hannity, and I'm going, oh, my goodness, you know, there's a difference between expressing conservative ideas and becoming a propaganda arm for the Breitbart wing of, the movement. And I think there's going to have to be a reckoning here. There's going to have to be some fallout afterwards, and I can't predict how that's going to play out.
Charlie, James Lilac's here in the Minneapolis market, which is desperately in need of you, just to say that again. You're absolutely right about talk radio, and Rob's correct about all of these various problems of scale and the fragmentation. But we used to think that the conservative movement, at least, was this solid mass in the tent, bound by iron bands of particular issues. And now it appears that we were just all held together with dental floss and were easily snipped apart. So is there any way to put this back together? And do we want to put it back together? The people who go to the far fringes of the worst page on Breitbart and InfoWars and the rest of this, do we want to have these people back in the tent?
Boy, that is a great question. I mean, you're absolutely right. We thought we had this big, coherent, intelligent, engaged movement, and we found out that maybe the principled, the intellectual principled conservatism was really like pie crust thin on top of this huge, toxic waste dump. So we'd like to put it back together, but I gotta tell you, I think there's also got to be this this moment at which we say, look, the alt-right cannot be part of this movement. We have to draw the lines. We have to define what we are, but also have to define what we're not. I don't know how you actually go about purging people from it. I know it's nostalgic to refer to, William F. Buckley Jr., what he did with the John Birch Society. But there are moments at which you go, you know what? If this is the movement, this alt-right, hyper-nationalist movement, then I'm not part of that movement. And that conservatism actually needs to go back to the drawing board, figure what we believe, who we want to be aligned with. And then there's going to have to be that sorting out. And it's not going to be pretty.
Well, as you saw this week, what happens when Paul Ryan announced he was a classical liberal? Everyone said, see, he admits it. He's a liberal. Well,
I need people. I really need people not to be so dumb. That's part of the problem. I really desperately need to grab people by the lapels and say, do you understand what the term classical liberal means? I mean, how did we get so stupid? And I say this because, those of us in talk radio, and I think in the conservative media, we really thought we were making people smarter, right? Didn't we think that we were the alternative voice and that we were going to create this mass of people who were engaged and interested and thoughtful? And instead we get this sort of thing. And it is sort of like you kind of want to pound your head on the desk occasionally when stories like that appear.
Well, it depends on the market and it depends on the host. I mean, there are lots of hosts that I listen to who are smart and engaged and decent people. And unfortunately, Wisconsin is about to lose one of theirs. So stay in the business somehow, because we hope to hear you again, not just after 2016, but after 2020.
Charlie, really quickly, Peter here, really quickly, this is a mandatory question. Does Senator Ron Johnson have a chance of winning his reelection bid against the very liberal Russ Feingold in your state?
I think he's got a chance. It's incredibly difficult, mainly because of the nature of the electorate. No Republican Senate candidate has won in a general election, the general election year since 1980, when Bob Casten won during the Reagan year. So it's definitely uphill. The polls are close, but this undertow of Donald Trump is probably just too much. I mean, I love Ron Johnson. I'm going to do everything I possibly can to help him. But this is going to be a huge that's a really tall mountain for him to climb.
Got it. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
As a radio guy, you know that I'd wrapped up the segment and was prepared to go to commercial when Peter jumped in there. But so you'll just have to pity me now, because I've got nothing left. So I'm just going to say thank you. We'll talk to you later.
Hey, well, thank you guys too. Bye bye.
Bye bye. You know, if you we should have some of the links in the piece when it goes up on Ricochet. But there's a Politico piece where he talks about talk radio and the role of talk radio and Breitbart and the rest of this, which, you know, a lot of us on the right who have been in various media are scratching our heads and saying, what did we do? He's wearing a tie in the studio, which I just love, because there's something about wearing a tie in the studio that makes you different. It gives you a different aspect. You speak differently. You conduct yourself differently. Just like if you wear a tie when you go in an airplane, you're less likely to berate the stewardess and take your shoes off and all the rest of it. You know? But who has time,
Peter,
to shop for?
I'm sorry. I really was interrupting a segue. I didn't mean to. So I will not interrupt the segue. Go ahead. I wasn't even trying to do a bit there, James. I was literally trying to. That's how good your segues are. They're so airtight. But because Reagan would never walk into the Oval Office without a tie as well as front set. Go ahead. Sorry.
Is that true, Peter?
Yes, that is true. Huh. That is true.
Is this something you perhaps tried to pass down to your son?
Oh, yeah. Well, could you possibly go about that, James? It's so hard to shop.
Well, I'm just saying, dragging a guy into the store sometimes, either they don't want to, or they don't have the time, or if they're a young man, they don't see the point because they just have their own style and code. But, you know, there is a way of looking that you want to look that a man should look, and it's just hard sometimes to find the time. Well, Trunk Club makes it easy for you to look your best in clothes that fit you perfectly and look amazing. And they're handpicked by your own personal stylist. How does this work? Well, go to trunkclub.com/ricochet, type in your measurements, share your likes and dislikes, and Trunk Club will send a trunk of clothing right to your door, handpicked by your stylist. Now, they're backed by Nordstrom, okay? Big name, big place, great place. So the stylists have access to the best designer brands. Try on your stylist selections, keep what you like, send back what you don't. Now, your stylist takes the time to understand your unique look and will build a perfect fall wardrobe for, you know, with timeless classics, well-made layers, and other seasonal essentials you need to get through these cold climes. But if you don't, let's say you live in Dallas or Los Angeles. Well, let's say you live in New York, Chicago, or D.C. and Charleston. You can just stop by one of the Trunk Club clubhouses to work with your stylist in person for free. This is not a subscription service. You can order clothes whenever you like from your own personal stylist. Take 5 days to try everything on, and returns, of course, they're always free. Get started today at trunkclub.com/ricochet. That's trunkclub/ricochet. Trunkclub.com. What did I say? /ricochet? That's what it is. Coming soon, by the way, Trunk Club is going to have a clubhouse in Boston opening in late fall. So if you're in the Boston area, be sure to stop by. And remember, your stylist is a professional trained in all of the brands that Trunk Club offers. So they're a pro, but what makes them priceless is your stylist's one-on-one relationship with you, understanding your likes, dislikes, and preferences. They can always help you look your best. So whether you go to the store or whether you do it on mail, you can make a statement at your next big event on your calendar this fall with a look that's handpicked just for you and your style.
And it works. I have seen it with my own eyes. I have pushed young Pedro Robinson into Trunk Club. He's now exchanged 4 trunks. He's taken a couple of items from every trunk, and he is gradually making the transition from college kid to young professional.
Wow, that clothes do matter. It does matter, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
It really kind of – that's a big deal. It's like I feel like when you – I mean, there is a – I mean, Ronald Reagan wearing a suit into the Oval Office even on a Saturday or Sunday, that mattered. That really did matter.
But I will also say, however, that my son still has his moments. Yesterday, I recorded an episode of Uncommon Knowledge with Anders Fogh Rasmussen, former Prime Minister of Denmark and Secretary General of NATO, who has a marvelous book out now called The Will to Lead, America's Indispensable Role. And the idea that a senior European would say that America needs to be more present in the world, not less, was so arresting that I taped an interview with him. He's a lovely man. And I warned my son, I wanted him to meet him, and I warned Pedro, look, he's a European, there are going to be certain standards of dress. I know it's in the morning, but I'm telling you, he'll be in a suit. And sure enough, the prime minister turns up. He's an extremely distinguished European, look, at 9:30 in the morning, in a dark, beautifully tailored suit with a lovely tie, and Pedro shows up in shorts and flip-flops.
Right. Well, you know. There you go. Well, that's like you can't actually fix that stuff. When I'm in LA, I tend to dress like a slob. When I'm in New York, I tend to dress up, just because you're in a big city. You kind of feel like you got to put it together a little bit. And just while we have a pause, can I just say something I neglected to say last week, and I was asked to, and I say it with all due enthusiasm. If you're listening to this podcast and you are not a member of Ricochet, please join. But one of the great things about Ricochet is that our members create a huge amount of fantastic content, conversations, clubhouses, little groups on the web behind in the member feed. They also create great podcasts. Michael Stopa does a great one, the Harvard Lunch Club, which is Stopa's a very big Trump supporter. And Ryan McPherson does one. The Flyover Country podcast is great. This the most recent one is really terrific and worth your time. Part of the experiment here at Ricochet is to sort of open up the airwaves and open up the front page of blogs to thoughtful discussion from all over the country. And something I had at the meetup on Wednesday was a couple of members said to me, one of the things they really loved was that series we did with members, or members just did spontaneously, where they would tell you a little bit about what they did and what they knew about in their lives and their industries and their businesses. And it was just spectacular. It was like 200, 300 posts were just fantastic. And I just thought I'd say that while I had a little moment.
Oh, it sounds like a great meetup. I wish I'd been there. Oddly enough, I was across the street in New York, and I kept meaning to walk over to it, but I don't know.
Well, it was pretty packed. It was pretty full.
It looked packed from the outside. But the thing of it is, if I went in there, I know that there'd be the Trump contingent and the anti-Trump contingent and the Evan McMullen contingent, because Ricochet contains multitudes. And a lot of people think it's biased one way or the other, but look at this podcast. We had an Everett Trumper on first, and now we're going to have somebody who makes a coherent, cogent case for Donald Trump's election, and that would be the estimable Victor Davis Hanson. American military historian, columnist, former classicist professor, and of course you can catch his weekly classicist podcast on the Ricochet Audio Network. Welcome back to the podcast, sir.
Thanks for having me.
I have to ask you, of course, is it more against Hillary, more for Trump? Where is the balance for you? 60-40, 70-30, 50-50, what?
I think it's about 51-49. Not 49 for Hillary, but 49 not voting. I mean, I look at Trump as the lesser of two evils, both his agenda and his personality. It seems to me that if you're a Democrat or a liberal and you don't vote for Hillary, then you're voting for Trump de facto. If you're a conservative and for whatever reason you do not vote for Trump, then you're voting for Hillary in a Manichaean election. And then I have to ask myself, dispassionately, whose agenda, maybe it's disingenuous, but whose published agenda on issues such as abortion, immigration, the deficit, defense spending, Obamacare, et cetera, is more conservative? I think empirically anybody would agree that Trump's stated agenda in his latest incarnation is much more conservative than Hillary's. Then the third question is there something in Trump's character that would either make him more unfit than Hillary or singularly unfit to be president? And given what he has said in the subjunctive mood rather than what she's done in the indicative, I can't see that argument being made. If you want to suggest some outrage that he's proposed, I think I could find a parallel with either a past president or Obama or Hillary in particular. So using all that criteria, I kind of shrug and say I would vote for Trump.
there's a ringing endorsement. I'll shrug and vote for Trump. All right.
Hey, Victor, it's Rob Long in New York. I'm in New York now, but I vote in California. I will vote in California. Why on earth would I ever vote for Donald Trump in California? He's not going to carry the state. I couldn't bring myself to vote for that man. I won't vote for her. I'll write somebody in, or I'll vote for Evan McMullen, or I'll vote for, I don't know, write my own name in to deprive Hillary of one more popular vote in a state she's clearly going to win. Why isn't that honorable?
I think it is. Did I say it wasn't? I think it is.
No. But
you're onto something. I think you're onto something, Rob, because notice that I, in sanctimonious fashion, have not said, how dare you? Here's my problem. Yeah. Here's my problem. When I walk across the Hoover campus at Stanford, or I talk to National Review editors, or and I'll mention some other, I can mention a lot of others. When somebody says they're going to shrug and vote for Trump, they're going to get a lecture, sanctimonious lecture. And when somebody says, you know what, I can't vote for him, I mean, there may be people angry. I have no problem with that whatsoever. But why do people come up to you and say, I can't believe you of all people are going to vote for him?
Right.
And you that's get what that. I you, think you is get... so sanctimonious and hypocritical. And I think collectively and nationwide is destroying the party. If you look at the National Review, which I'm very proud to be a part of, but you look at the corner postings, and I won't mention the writers, it's utter contempt and vicious disparagement of millions of deplorables. It really is. And I don't see, I can see some of them getting mad back at them, but boy, it's sort of the journalistic equivalent of Colin Kaepernick taking his knee and expecting NFL attendance to go up. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen to insult people and then think that everybody's going to just, happy as can be, join back again after this thing's over. It's suicidal.
How toxic is the relationship, though, or the connections within the party? Because, I write the funny humor column, Victor. I'm at the kids' table there. But all my never-Trumper friends who were mostly associated with NR will show me their emails and their Twitter at replies filled with the most extraordinary loathsome hate. Yep. Like, it's really it is staggering. It takes my breath away.
But they don't ever ask themselves, though. They don't ever ask themselves in their self-absorption. They never ask themselves, do we do the same thing? And the fact is,
I think it's fair to say that Jonah
Max Boot and see that he said, look what he said today. Look what he wrote about. He would prefer Stalin to Trump. And
Max wrote that?
Yes, he did. I can cite, I'm doing it at my website now. Every day I'm doing an angry reader. I have 300 emails that call you fascist, Nazi. I'm never going to speak. So it happens on both sides. But my point is only the never Trump or the wounded fawns. Oh, how can they do this to me? Well, in fact, if you read the National Review, I've written a lot of pieces on Trump. You know, I have a policy. I've never once mentioned one National Review writer by name, not one. They do all the time. How could Mike Pence do that? How could this person do it? So I think by any fair measure, the outrage. I'll give you one other example very quickly. So Trump says, I don't know if I'm going to stand by the election result or not. Well, who cares whether he says so or not? It's going to happen whether he likes it or not. But the whole conservative blogosphere goes, not in my name. Right. How can he dare say this? And then you think for a second, where did this term selected, not elected come from? The 2000 election?
Exactly.
Who said 2004 that Kerry was robbed of Ohio and thus the election?
But these are after the fact, right? That's the difference. These are after.
About, what was 1876 about? What was 1916 about? What was 1960 about? Voter fraud. And then I hear all these people say, we've never had this happen. And then I ask two more questions. One, what was John Fund doing in National Review for the last 15 years, writing
exactly
every month, voter fraud. And then he writes a book for Encounter called Stealing Elections. And all these conservatives were outraged. We've got to have driver's license. We've got to do this. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, one guy says, I'm going to reify that and concretely say what all of these pundits have been arguing. And then suddenly he's Hitler? Come on. And the second thing is, if there is another WikiLeaks, one more, two more that are catastrophic in dimension that really tie Hillary to criminal activity, and I don't think that's impossible, and she should lose. Do you think that the Democratic Party will not say that Vladimir Putin rigged the election and she would have won otherwise? And he did so primarily not to hurt the administration, which he hates, but primarily to help his, as Obama called it, his bro, Trump. They're going to allege that from the minute she loses the election, if she were to. So I don't understand this. We're going to be so morally upright on the conservative side, and they don't expect any reciprocity from the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm just going to ask you this one question because and you may disagree. I don't know how I feel about it, but to me, it seems like there's a difference. This is a sort of a silly thing to say, but between calling somebody a fascist and a hater and a Nazi, all of which I've been called, which is hilarious, and calling somebody a Jew bastard.
There is.
And a dirty Jew. That's the stuff that bothers me. And I've been called that, and I'm a proud Episcopalian. I mean,
if it's any solace, I get asked about three times a year whether I'm Jewish, because I'm very supportive of Israel. So, and that's not always from the right, believe me. It's mostly from the left.
Exactly. No, I agree with that.
Semitism is now mostly a left-wing monopoly. But I understand that. But on the other hand, I'm not trying to suggest that I'm not trying to suggest that people are mad at so-called neocons because, a number of Jewish scholars are very rabidly pro-Trump, and that can be people like David Horowitz. And then, B, the most disdainful of Trump tend to be people like George Will. So right. I don't think that he's getting those comments, and I don't think that David Horowitz is getting those comments. But I do agree that liberal Jewish pundits like Britt Stevens, Elliot Cohen, Max Boot are disparaged in anti-Semitic fashion. I would agree that happens, and it's deplorable, and I think it's terrible. But I do think that other people suffer from the same type of, I don't know which is worse, to be called a Jew bastard or to be called a Hitlerite.
That's right.
Hitlerite. And, you know, my family's Hitler, so I'm supposed to read. I get that every day. Yesterday I got called Marshall Patton by a professor.
So, that's actually elevated.
Not if you remember Patton.
But of all the things you can call you, that's a little sense classy.
To be hung.
Yeah. So I have one more question. I know that Peter wants to get in. And it's more of a tactical question. Is it crazy or outlandish for a clear-eyed Republican or conservative to look at the polls, this trend line of the polls, all the polls since March, and to look at the areas in which Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, has had a gigantic voter and support deficit that has not ever really approached anything that he needs to get to win the presidency, to say, hey, listen, even if I love the guy, if I agree with him, he's a loser, he's dead weight, toss him overboard, save yourself, save the party. Isn't that also, I mean, it's not nice and it's, you know, but politics ain't beanbag. This guy seems to me to be a gigantic loser. I think, you know, the thing that you do with losers is you dump them off the boat and try to save your majority. Is that fair?
No, I can see the logic of many people doing that. I've never attacked anybody for that. I have members of my best friends that are doing just that. However, the only problem with it is I'm not convinced yet that divorcing yourself from Trump, given that I think the latest poll I saw yesterday, it said 51% of Republicans in a poll suggested that they're more aligned with Trump than Paul Ryan. I don't agree with that, but I'm just saying if you're a candidate and you think you're going to win by disconnecting yourself from Trump, I'm not sure that that's going to help you and might hurt you more than it will help you, but depending on the state. And right. Two, there's something weird about this. I agree that only a romantic Trumpster would say he's going to win by a landslide. And I hear that all the time, and I can't understand it. But there's a couple things this year that make things a little bit different. Number one is the Brexit vote, which has cast into doubt the polling mechanism in the Anglo-speaking world about under-reporting right-wing views. And second, we've got this strange things where all the traditional polls have Trump losing nationwide from 5 to 9% in mm-hmm. DC, Wall Street Journal, Reuters, Gallup. All these are very good polls. But then we have this other thing, these three daily tracking, not one, not two, but three, IBD, TPP as one, Rasmussen as two, and the LA Times USC poll. And they all have a couple things in common. Number one, they've all had Trump way down in uh-huh. May and June. And two, if you go back to the 2012 record of all the polls, they did better on average than did the traditional polls. And three, they all share a mechanism of having a static body of people who sort of, I think, as I understand it, electronically signify every day who they like that particular day, rather than having a new sampling that is phoned right. in and you have to say, right. I like Trump, I like Hillary, which I don't know. All I know, what I'm suggesting to you is that there's a difference, and we're going to find out on November 8th whether the conventional wisdom that these three tracking polls are bankrupt or whether something's very strange happening. And I don't know the answer to that. I really don't. But I do know there's enough doubt that when I hear one of these, and I just got off the phone with one who said, hey, Victor, whether you like it or not, Trump's going to win by 5. And I said, it is, because people will always say they're going to vote for Hillary, but they never say they're going to vote for Trump.
I know Peter wants to jump in, but just to
– No, go ahead.
The Brexit polls, though, in the last 2 weeks leading up to the vote, there of the polls, I think 14 said were strongly leave, 12 were strongly – or 11 were strongly stay, and 3 were a tie. So leading up to the actual vote, the Brexit polls were pretty clear indication that
look at the bookie,
was going to win.
Even the bookies the night before or the morning right. of the election, it was – odds, as I understand it, were 65, 35.
Oh, yeah, you can make a lot of dough. But the polls themselves were last two weeks indicated that.
Remember, there was that terrible murder of the labor politician, attractive young woman who was a labor politician.
Yeah.
And the polls reversed after that and showed that Leave had moved back ahead. And then what the polls failed to pick up was that Leave then sank back to where it had been effectively, I think. But there's a fascinating piece. Well, I mean, it fascinated me. I think it'd be very easy for Rob to dismiss it. I don't know what Victor would make of it. There's a piece in the Telegraph of London yesterday on bookies saying that they're seeing the same pattern in betting on Trump. And bear in mind, these are English people. They don't have a horse in the race.
I saw that.
Right. Earlier. They see the same pattern. The money is on Hillary Clinton, but the number of bets, that is to say smaller bets for lower amounts of money, are on Trump. That was the same pattern as in Brexit. Part of it is, of course, explained by the odds. If you've got – the only way you can make money by betting on Hillary is by putting down a big sum. You could make the odds against Donald are so high you can put down a small bet and hope to gain. But the professionals said that doesn't explain it all. They're seeing something of the same pattern.
I
don't know what that means.
I think the whole thing, to sum up on both the polls and Trump, is that I don't have a lot of animosity. In fact, I have none for when I read sort of outrageous things I think that are outrageous written by Brett Stevens or John Podhoretz or Max Boot or George Will. I understand it because Trump is a vulgarian. He's crude. And the Republicans define morality as personal control of the appetites, whereas the liberal and democratic mindset says, you know what, any means are necessary and allowable and permittable to gain cosmic egalitarianism. So the ends always justify. I understand that. But what I don't quite understand is what drives that furor in an asymmetrical fashion, because if I say to a National Review writer or an editor or publisher or somebody, why don't we just have a policy that for every furious, rabid anti-Trump, we have one anti-Hillary, or one that suggests right. this is a tragedy.
Yeah. And not everyone ends up dead on stage. Yeah. It's like,
yeah. And not a melodrama, because what we have is a tragedy, because Trump articulated issues that were not articulated in the past. He did so with reckless abandon, and all the people, it's even worse than a tragedy. It's a nightmare, because all the people who were much better experienced, much more knowledgeable, much preferable candidates that I voted for, and I voted for one in the right. primary, all of those probably wouldn't be where Trump is now within 3 or 4 or 5 points, I don't think, because they lacked the animal cunning and energy that he did, which I abhorred. And then second, they say, why can't Trump, Peggy Noonan writes today, why can't Trump just be sane? Well, if he was sane, he wouldn't be winning, because right. he's insane. And that means that people think he's going to take a ball and chain and throw it into the proverbial Apple's computer screen and destroy everything. And that's what they want. It's Samson tearing down the Philistine temple and himself with it. And I see that every day, not at Hoover and not at Stanford and not in National Review pages, but out in Fresno County. Boy, I see it every day. And when you pick up the Wall Street Journal last 10 years and their immigration policy is exactly the same as the voice of Aslan, then they're not reflecting their conservative base at all.
And I just to finish up, I have just one comment and one question. The comment is, you wrote a very thoughtful, measured book about immigration as regards California called Mexifornia. And for that, you were called a whole slew of names. You know, it's a pretty chill book, as the kids say. It's not, you know, it's a well-reasoned, thoughtful book. Donald Trump says basically the same stuff, kind of, but in an incendiary way, a crazy way. And he's called the same names. So they call you names whether you make sense or you don't make sense. They're going to call you names whether you have an argument or you don't have an argument. I definitely agree with that. But can I ask you a personal question? Just
yeah.
You and I and some of the people that you've named and a lot of those people are going to be – we're all going to be on the National Review cruise together.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's a metaphor.
Yeah. Okay. But can I make you a prediction?
Yeah.
I will predict, and I'll put my proverbial honor on the line, that I will not go up one time to anybody on that cruise and say, how dare you not vote, or dare you attack the Republican nominee and therefore empower Hillary Clinton and an anti-American disastrous agenda. I won't do it once. But I also predict that one of those, and I won't mention the names, will come up to me and say, I'm very disappointed in you. And then I'll make another prediction, if I may, in closing. I won't make a prediction. I'll make an affirmation. I have never once in my 15 years of writing op-eds ever joined in with a candidate and given them advice or formally worked for them. I get called all the time by candidates, and I say, I can talk about the world, but I'm not going to join your campaign as an advisor.
Right.
If you took the number of National Review writers who, A, were formally working for a campaign, or B, whose spouse was formally working for a campaign, or C, were close personal friends of one of the candidates, and that reflected in their writing, I would resign. It's unethical. And yet they all did that. Not all, but almost all of them. And nobody says a word. And then they say, wow, why is everybody mad? And the answer is that even though those are very good people and they're disinterested and I think they're very ethical, that gives the appearance that feeds this Trump paranoia that there's a Washington, New York coastal corridor where everybody has cappuccino like divorce lawyers after the election. And they go over and talk to the New Republic guys, right, and they talk right. to the Nation guys, and they're all in the same social milieu, and they all went to the same schools, and ha, 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 you guys have your Bernie Sanders guys in the basement, and we have our Trump guys at NASCAR, ha, ha. And maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but when you have op-ed writers, And I mean, if George Will's wife is working for the Walker campaign, and I won't mention the National Review people that were involved with various, that's not ethical. And then for those same writers to turn around and say it's not ethical to support Trump as the lesser of two evils, I don't understand it. Or when I'll mention one name, when David French is floating himself as a candidate, when he's writing op-eds about his would-be and imagined opponent, that's not ethical. And the magazine did not distance itself quickly enough from that. And the magazine, as I said, and I'm on record of saying this, should have a policy that anybody who writes opinion journalism shall not be formally involved, or their spouse should not be formally involved in an ongoing presidential campaign. And I think that drove a lot of the animus, that they got very angry at this Trump. For me, you know, if Trump wins, I did not want the guy to win. I thought he would not win. I tried to do everything. I wrote things very critical of a lot of his lies. But once he won, I was not vested in opposing him in a professional sense, right, which some people gave the appearance that they were.
Hmm. Well, I won't be coming up to you in the ship, Victor, and saying that I'm
not. But believe me, I think I'm accurate on that. Somebody
probably,
will come
my,
up.
My idea is that everybody at some point is going to disappoint me, and I'm going to disappoint everybody at some point. So I want to extend to them.
Your position is one that I considered very logically. I rejected it, but I understand exactly where you're from. I think no less of you for doing it. I can understand your reasoning. More power to it. But I'm not,
and that goes both ways. But I
suggest that somehow you're morally culpable if Hillary gets elected. I'm not going to do that.
No. Oh, he is, but for other reasons.
Well, last question. Those of us who live in a state like Minnesota, Trump isn't going to win.
No,
he's just not. So I don't have to vote for him as part of that strategic binary Manichaean choice. But can you see why somebody would say I'm not going to vote for him in this context? Because if he's not going to win, it's not a question of blocking Hillary. It becomes affirming him. And if you have objections to the man,
I think that's absolutely, especially if you're going to vote for the down ticket conservatives. I think that's an absolutely legitimate point of view. I've heard some of my best friends, family members say they're going to do it in California. More power to them. I think it becomes a little bit problematic, as you've already implied, in states like Ohio or Florida or North Carolina, because it's still open.
Right.
And Hillary, for me, it's, you know, Hillary is something, she's a rare bird. We haven't quite seen, I know he is, but he's in the subjunctive. She's the indicative. We know what she's going to do and what she's done. And it's a criminal enterprise. I see it, the foundation and what she's done with her server and the Podesta Trove, et cetera.
Well, everyone, there is still time to sign up for the National Review cruise, because at the Crow's Nest, probably at 11 o'clock, you'll hear the smashing of glasses.
Yes.
As Victor breaks a glass and David French breaks a mug, and it's the classicist versus the military lawyer.
I think I've been performing a useful service as the useful idiot for National Review, where I've been writing and people come up. Every time I go anywhere, Hillsdale College, I just got back from the Air Force Academy. People come up and say, well, I'm glad that they haven't ostracized you. They must be not that bad because they let you write this stuff. And I think,
yes, it's world in which Victor Hansen is the useful idiot.
Right,
he speaks
right,
a level
right.
of Olympian intelligence that the world has probably not seen before. Hey, we'll see you on the ship. Thank you very much for a grand conversation. And
thank you, guys.
Victor, I owe you a drink on the cruise for sure.
I hope so.
That's the least I can do.
And don't throw it in my face.
Victor, when Rob says he owes you something, get that in writing really quickly.
Yeah, I'm Clintonian.
Let me ask one last question. Who are the National Review staff going to be sadder if Hillary or Trump wins? I'm serious.
I think they're going to be – I don't know. That's a really good question. I think a lot of us – are already have reached a conclusion about what's going to happen. And so we believe that I'm pretty sad about President Hillary Clinton. But I was prepared to be sad about President Hillary Clinton in 2008. So I'm just really going into my bag of tricks at this point. I think to be fair, most of them are now, I can't speak for most of them. I don't really know what most of them do, but for me, I'm making tactical arguments. I'm building an arc and trying to build, I think we need to build an arc and figure out who's going to be on the arc through the stormy seas in the next two, what I hope is only
That's
2 years.
I'm going to drop out. I'm already dropped out, but I'm going to drop out even further into Selma, California.
No. You can't drop out of this. You got to stay here because I think we need to figure out where we're going to go in November.
Up the ramp into the arc the conservatives go, two by two, the pundit and the lobbyist, the pundit and the campaign strategy. Being married to somebody else in the great Bosnian wash machine. Victor, we'll see you later. And thanks for being on the podcast.
See you guys.
Thanks, Victor.
Yeah.
It's a good question.
This is a silly thing to talk about here, right? Okay. But still, like, we're all going to be on that boat.
Right.
You and me and Jonah and John Podoritz and Victor Hansen and David French, a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that's going to be a snapshot in some way of the Republican Party or the conservative movement, or what do you want to call it, after November. And I know that the people who believe that there's some miracle going to happen in the next 2.5 weeks, just accept for a minute that there isn't going to be one. We're all going to have to figure out how to move forward from this, right?
Yes, and the fun is going to be, Rob, when it's you, me, and Jonah on stage doing the Night Owl, and there's no way we're going to be able to read that crowd, is there?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's fun. Well, the thing of it is that, I mean, if you go to Ricochet and spend a lot of time and go to the member comments, whatnot, you can figure out those people with whom you could disagree civilly and respect them. I mean, sometimes you feel like Rommel saluting, you know, Montgomery or Patton or something like that. We may be on opposite sides, and I'm not saying you're the Nazi, but I salute you, sir. And with fine commentators and fine people in the comments, and there's respect. And as long as there's that respect and not the condemnation of, you idiot, how could you lead the nation into complete and utter rack and ruin, we'll get along fine. And I think within the magazine itself, even though there will be disparate voices and amongst the passengers, disparate opinions, there is still an idea that holds it together, because National Review is more than just – well, it's – it's a set of ideas that it's more robust and more diverse than, say, for example, your average running magazine or a magazine about women's fitness, which are about one thing. Okay.
But how can you keep track of all the magazines, though?
Well, it's tough.
There's too many magazines.
It's impossible, you'd think. But it really isn't, because if you had an app that would allow you to go and look at all of the, you know, I notice everybody saying that this way. There's a millennial at work who says that. My daughter says that. Now you're saying that. What?
Oh, we
Become the WhatsApp of the 21st century?
I don't know. We used to do that in the writer's room all the time. In the writer's room, when someone would say something, when they were leading up to someone, I've been doing it forever.
Well, like
I've been a millennial forever, James.
Yes, like the Rage Virus in 28 days, it's escaped out into the general public. So, Rob said about the idea that you could find all of your magazines in one spot. You can, and that spot is in your hands, on your laptop, or any other machine for that matter that's connected to the old internet, because texture is the thing. Texture is completely reimagined magazines. Texture is the app. It is not an attribute. It is the app. It gives you the articles and the stories that you really want all in one place, and interactive features as well, with videos and recommendations just for you. Now, the app lets you tune into the most popular magazines in the world anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or your tablet. And let me tell you this, if you want to read a magazine the way that they were, that Muncie meant them to be read, you can do it. Start to finish, page after page, jump to jump. The magazine is a magazine, but you can also tease out certain little details. It makes it easy to find the articles you care about. Now, I regularly read Condé Nast Traveler. I read that aforementioned Women Fitness magazine because it's hot. And other things, too. You can save them. You can select them. You can put articles aside. And plus, the Texture editorial team will recommend content for me based on stuff that I've looked at. So every day I can dive deeper into my personalized collections. And, you know, I can just carry it around. And even if I don't have an internet signal, call it up and read. Like a real magazine. Like an actual magazine. Now, sign up for Texture right now and gain insider access to all the content from the world's best publications. Now, it's free. That's right. We're offering you a trial free now when you go to texture.com/ricochet. You'll gain immediate entry to all the top magazines, including back issues and bonus video content. Start binge reading for free, and you will, believe me. Because you know how it is. You get some of these offers for a free magazine, and it's, you know, Farbs, you know, Carr and Dowser or something, and it's, you know, what are these things? These are all the magazines that you want to read, and there's tons of them. Tons. And it's not going to be like you're going to get something in the mailbox that you feel obligated to drag to the bathroom and then obligated to drag to the recycling and you never took a look at it. What's always right there in your hand and your app, believe me, you'll look at it. So go to texture.com right now. Texture.com/ricochet. Texture.com/ricochet. Start your free trial. And we thank Texture for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Rob, you may have noticed that Peter passed out. He just there was something about the passion in Victor's voice that I think just made him faint, because Victor is such a even keeled temperamental fellow, right?
Yeah, like I think about hearing Victor speak, it's hard not to want to applaud just the general sobriety of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the reasons why this election is so horrible. And I can only come up with personal examples. So I can only think of like actual personal examples. One of them is, of course, what's going to happen on the cruise. And I hope that if there are bad feelings, that there's rapprochement. And I always pitch Michael Stopa's podcast, because he's a staunch Trump supporter and has been for months and months and months and months. And he came down to the debate watching party, and we sat together and had a drink and watched it and agreed and disagreed over certain things about the debate. But it was, we got to get it together, our side. That's all.
Well, it goes back to what I was saying before with Charlie Sykes. Maybe we don't, maybe we can't, maybe we oughtn't. If the together was the illusion of great commonality and also included, and I'm not doing the deplorables thing here, but I'm talking about some of the unsavory elements of the alt-right, however numerous they may be. I don't want those people. I don't want them around. I don't want the economic nationalists who want, who are sort of stomping around and saying, well, we don't have a white pride culture month. I mean, I don't want to overestimate their number. I don't want to give them too much, much credence. But, unfortunately, there's this piece I read by a minority conservative who's saying, for years I thought that you liked me because we had the same ideas, and that ideas were what bound us together. Now, seeing what I see and hearing what I hear, I don't feel welcome anymore. You can argue with whether or not that's actually correct. You can argue about how much that is a reflection of how the media has treated what Trump has said, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's there, and it's happening, and it's real. When Victor said that Trump articulated something, he mentioned something. He brought up something. He didn't articulate it. And that's one of the most frustrating things about this.
Yeah.
Even if we could set aside the character, some of the things about the person's characteristic that we don't like, there's always going to be that. Even if we can set aside comments and issues that we don't agree with, because there's always going to be that, there's just the incompetence of it.
Yeah.
Rankles. So I just want to say that in the last debate, in the middle of a question about grabbing and the sexual assault questions, that's where he brought up the James O'Keefe Veritas videos. And he did it without context, without explication, just dumped it in there, to the point where somebody in the comments was saying, I wish Trump had mentioned that about voter fraud. Well, he did, but he didn't know how to do it, and he couldn't give it any context. And there was no way that he made anybody go. The Washington Post, in annotating that speech that he gave, actually took that aside, broke it out into a little sidebar, and linked to their own story on the O'Keefe Veritas firings and dismissals. So they did a better job of explaining. That's the thing. Everybody's great at explaining what Trump meant or should do. As to the man himself, he cannot.
And that happens a lot. That happens a lot with our side. I mean, to be fair, it's not a Trump.
Yeah, but it wasn't supposed to happen with this side. This guy was supposed to be, if you look back at the old film, somebody said, if you look at Trump speaking in the 90s, he could speak in complete sentences. He actually did. Yeah. And there was a certain rhetorical skill there. It was Carnival Barker. It was charming. It was effective. But anyway, I don't think
when he speaks fluently and fluidly and without these kind of gaffes, it's usually when he's making an argument for why Bill Clinton's a great president and Hillary Clinton's a great first lady, and why he's in favor of Planned Parenthood and he's incredibly pro-choice. That's when he speaks absolutely from the heart. That's what he's saying. That said, give him credit. It was the most compelling and direct repudiation of the idea of partial birth abortion that anybody has heard in a long time. Mm-hmm. That there's a certain that frankness and that graphic language which most Republican presidents kind of instinctively shy away from, even when they have real pro-life bona fides, unlike Trump and unlike some others, right? He went there. He said, this is why we're against it, because it's infanticide. And I feel like – obviously the Ricochet meetup room was cheering. It's just one of those things where you see glimmers of what what a campaign could be. The problem is the math, right? The math problem is that in order to get the number that he wants to get of the from the population that seems to be supporting him, he's turning people off 2-1. And that's just not how you, you know, it's not how you win a 51% nation as a chief executive. So that's that.
That must have terrified New Yorkers. I can imagine them realizing to their horror that there are people in this bar cheering somebody accurately describing partial birth abortion.
Yeah, I can't really tell. I was
people applauding the yeah. people applauding the gruesome the finally gruesome details because somebody's finally said how awful this is, and these people are happy about the monsters. You must right. have all seemed like to know.
Well, John O'Sullivan was there. You know, the great John O'Sullivan, former editor mm-hmm. National Review, English should have got. I've been in between Australia and Budapest. That's where it basically. So right. John is an international man of mystery, and he's got these great half you know, reading glasses, and he's got this yes. Distinguished gray hair. And John is pretty much. I don't really know if he's a Trump supporter, but he's very sympathetic to Trump. And very sympathetic, and I'm sure he's a Trump voter. I'm not 100%. But sure. And at one point, I looked over to him after that debate, after that partial birth abortion answer, and he kind of looked at me and kind of like a little, you know, slight impishly with a little bit of cross looking because he said, "You have to admit, it's a very good answer." And mm-hmm. I said, "Yeah, it's a really good answer. It's a really good answer." Look, I'm a futurist, so I futurize, as they say in psychotherapy. I think about what's going to happen in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and you know, we just have to decide the two or three or four things that we really care about as conservatives. We no longer have the luxury of having a list of 20. We've got to pick two or three, and we have to focus on those and those only. And we have to rebuild the brand if what happens in November, I think, happens. We've been here before. It's not a disaster. I mean, it is a disaster, but we've been here before, and it's a good time for us to recommit to the things that we really care about and jettison things that we don't, and to pick two or three to really sell to the American people. Ben Sasse made a very good there's a very good piece today. I read it, and I can't remember. And I feel like an idiot. But Ben Sasse retweeted it. If you follow Ben Sasse under Ben Sasse, he retweeted it. And he said, look, I believe in a low tax environment, just like everybody else. But a party that has as its primary talking point the marginal tax rate is a party that's going to die. I'm paraphrasing. That's pretty much what he said, and I think he's probably right.
Well, I just wish this schism had been revealed earlier, and we'd come to this year. But then again, on the other hand, look at it this way. It's the person who comes after the popular two-term president who inherits the weariness with the party and the inevitable recession. So So that's what we have. I'm just realizing I just said all we have to look forward to is economic growth and the Democrat approach to raising taxes and more deficit spending.
Look, I believe Larry Kudlow is correct that economic growth, real economic growth, across the board economic growth. That's meaningful and sustainable, which is, of course, can happen. It's challenging in the era we live in with like increased productivity and all sorts of things happening. But it is possible to happen. That will take care of a huge part of this people's legitimate anger that the country is moving away from them. If the pie is expanding and the economy is expanding and we have actual economic growth, which we ain't going to get under her, but with the Republican Congress and Republican Senate, you know, that helps. Look, we had great years with Newt Gingrich and a variety of Republicans at the head of the at the head of the government in the legislative branch in 1994. We had some really great years, and the Clinton big government plan was stopped dead in its tracks.
Right, but it's also where that growth happens. I mean, if the big cities continue to thrive and you get more real estate bubbles and we think everything's going fantastic because the number of millionaire apartments going up in New York is higher than it's ever been, it's got to go down to the elemental level where people have no jobs and are growing up in traditions of having no jobs and see the state and OxyContin is nothing. I mean, it's there are grim places in America that need more growth. Growth will help, but it's the start.
Yeah, it's a start, but we also have to, as conservative Republicans, we have to have a more modern view. It is true that you know, Hillary Clinton's attack on the coal industry is absolutely indefensible, and we have to fight for those people because clean coal technology actually works. But so does nuclear technology. We need to bring that back. But the idea that people keep talking about steel. the Soviet Union outperformed us and outmanufactured steel. Our country, they outperformed our country up until the fall of the Soviet Union and the collapse of their economy. That's not a very good metric. That's not a future metric.
Well, we make more steel now than we did in the heyday. We just don't employ as many people doing it.
Right.
And most of it is recycling and repurposing scrap. Yes, it's big. It's huge. It's changing. It's a big, complex ball of
and look,
thorny statistics. And
when they when they start making these phones that you and I love, and laptops and iPads, they're entirely made by robots, which is going to happen. You know, measured in the number of months. I mean, this is how fast things change. Things change so quickly that they've been predicting auto drive cars for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. Well, Tesla just did one this week. These things are happening really fast, and when the fabrication plants are built for the robots to build the iPhones, those robots will be built in the United States. Why not? Why would you pay for shipping? But they're not going to bring jobs back. Except there'll be some jobs back. They'll just bring a little bit more of a growing economy back. So we sort of have to be – I think we have to be thinking about the future rather than recapturing some kind of lost industrial past, which will never come back.
Right. The skies are not going to darken with the smoke, with the product of the smokestacks anymore, and it's not going to be the people tromping out in their work clothes with their lunch packets at 5 o'clock after the whistle blows. We will have matter replication technology that will now incredible opulence and abundance to absolutely everybody, because whatever you want, without having to pay for it, you'll have to just push a little button and it will be materialized out of energy, just like in Star Trek. And then people will not need a job; they will just sit in a chair with a catheter attached in a feeding tube and a 3D set of VR glasses, and we'll spend their time watching feelies. And we've gone from, we feared 1984, but it turns out that Brave New World was the one that we should have feared a little bit, just as much. And on that happy, cheerful note,
or Wally.
Well, I was going to say, when it comes to her war on coal and her war on everything and her war on all this, the only consolation I have with this miserable person is that I don't think that she believes any of it. That's the thing. Some people say she's an absolute Chomskyite, Alinskyite ideologue from the start. I don't think she believes. I think she believes whatever gets her the lucre and the respect. And you can take that one up.
I hope that's true.
Mm-hmm. You can take that up in the comments if you like. But you should also, this very moment, before you do anything else, go to harryshave.com, texture.com, and trunkclub.com and use that coupon code Ricochet to get wonderful deals and free stuff. And also, you might want to try the Ricochet store for some swag, so you can walk around town with a R emblazoned on your chest, and people will say, "My, what is that?" And you'll tell them. If you enjoyed the show, by the way, go to iTunes and leave a little review, preferably a nice one. That'll allow new reviewers, new listeners to discover us, and that keeps the show going and helps keep us up to 1,500. Thank you for listening. Thanks to all of our guests. And somebody slap Peter. Just try the smelling salts, because he's still not cold. See y'all in the comments.
Next week, James.
Running to and fro, hard working at the mill, never fail in the mill, yet come a rotten bill. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Salesman talking to me, trying to run me up a creek, say so you can buy it, go on, try it, you can pay me next week. Ah, too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Good looking, trying to get me hooked, want me to marry, get a home, settle down, write a book. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved. Same thing every day, getting up, going to school, no need of me complaining, my objections overrule. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.
Payphone, something wrong, dime gone, will mail, order suit or operator for telling me a tale. Ah. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Been to Yokohama, been fighting in the war. Army bunk, army chow, army crews, army car. Ha. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Working in the filling station, too many tasks. Wipe the windows, check the tires, check the oil, a dollar gas. Ha. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business. I don't want your botheration. Get away, leave me be.
But what we want to do is to replenish the Social Security Trust Fund.